I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is in the news, that is the news in many ways. The question of the danger of technology, in particular, technology connected to China and the Chinese Communist Party. You've heard about it, but today we are delighted, we're honored to have with us a true expert in the subject who can shed a lot of light where we've had a lot of heat on the subject. We need a little bit more light on it. And we are joined today for that conversation by Brian Kavanaugh. Brian is Senior Vice President at American Global Strategies. His particular area of emphasis, he comes, of course, out of the White House and out of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And in his time, he has focused in particular on critical infrastructure security, the very kinds of things that we're talking about today in 2024. He also, for those of you who are fans of the hard court, was on the national championship team for the University of Maryland men's basketball. I have to say, as a myself, a UVA grad, all right, grudgingly, well done. Congratulations on that. Great. And of course, they won the ACC championship, I think, in 2004. So obviously a terrific experience. Both in athletics and then has brought his acumen to the study of serious policy challenges facing America and American national security policy. Brian Kavanaugh, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Jeff, thank you so much for hosting me on the show. I really look forward to kind of, like you said, shedding some light on an issue that certainly warrants a healthy dose of light and letting the American people understand what is happening here.
So let's start with that. Your article is entitled Trojan Horse. And you have written about the infiltration into American life, in American technology, in American public consciousness and infrastructure of Chinese technology, in particular technology connected to the Chinese Communist Party. Why are you writing something about Trojan Horse?
I think what this really, for me, is an opportunity to kind of further educate the American people about the threats posed by the Chinese Communist Party. This goes back to when I was at the National Security Council as the Senior Director for Resilience. One of the key areas that I was focused on was protecting U.S. critical infrastructure from foreign adversaries. I was looking at cyber attacks. We were looking at other national security risks. And really, by virtue of the way we have critical infrastructure sectors, election security fell under the government sector. So I had election security from 2018 to 2021. And that really included a lot of foreign malign influence. And when we started peeling the layers of the onion back, what you find here is the Chinese Communist Party over time has just really created an expansive capability at collecting intelligence, collecting data, and they're not using it for, you know, marketers collect a lot of data off our cell phone every single day, and the American people seem pretty passe about that. They're using the data to target advertisements. The Chinese are not going to use the data to target advertisements, and there's a lot of data people don't realize you're sharing when you download apps and when you do purchases online, and when you use something as simple as like TikTok or Temu. So the Trojan horse in your pocket is really just trying to help educate Americans to the power that you hold in your pocket every single day.
So I think a lot of our listeners are pretty savvy about, of course, historical events, but also contemporary public issues. They will certainly have heard about the controversy over TikTok. Is it isolated to TikTok, or is it the problem broader than that?
Much, much more broader. And I think TikTok was a when you first started hearing about TikTok, the reason it caught on so quickly and was easy to identify is the name. It's a product, it's a thing, it's tangible. It's easier for people to understand. And a lot of times what I try to do is kind of unpack this and look at it through what the threat the CCP poses or the Chinese Communist Party poses. And my current boss and my former boss, the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, he's noted that we didn't arrive at this point haphazardly. Over the last three or four decades, there was a series of decisions made, both Republican and Democrats, that we were trying to cultivate and open a democratic China. It was born out of our innate optimism. So every time they would do something, whether it was human rights violations or unprecedented IP theft, unfair trade practices, or even currency manipulation, we were inclined to turn a blind eye in the hopes that they would develop into a prosperous country and adopt more democratic ideals and become part of the free West, if you will. Instead, what happened, the story everyone's very familiar with now is China's grown in their wealth. And as they did so, they became much more authoritarian, much more adversarial, and they've expanded territorial disputes now. They're building islands in sections that used to just be vast open sea. And so I really appreciate you having me on today because I think this is like an opportunity to further something that started in 2020 under the Trump administration. I think you witnessed a series of senior advisors. I remember starting in May of 2020, we really hit very publicly Robert O'Brien, Matt Pottinger, Chris Wray, Bill Barr, Mike Pompeo, and President Trump came out and spoke in various speeches across the summer of 2020 about what's happening with China and trying to kind of, in the national security and the intelligence community, we had seen it, we started to get accustomed to it, but you're not going to be able to address the issue in secrecy. So I think, we had Ambassador Brian in one of his speeches noted that we can no longer afford to close our eyes or ears to what China's doing. And then Chris Wray famously said that, the CCP's intellectual property theft represented the greatest transfer of human wealth in the history of mankind. Those things kind of resonated. And
yeah, that's really that's a staggering claim.
I think it is. And I think if I remember back to 2020, there was a case that the FBI was turning over to DOJ to prosecute where a single human was responsible for $1.5 billion in IP theft associated with the Thousand Talents Program, which is a Chinese front organization.
Wow, that's amazing. Can I push a little bit more on that? Because I think some of our listeners are thinking, well, how does the Chinese Communist Party actually do this? Do they do it themselves? Do they do it through Chinese government actors? They do it through private corporations that are based in China. What is the way that they are, in fact, for example, on intellectual property? How are they actually stealing intellectual property?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. And it's actually a multifaceted whole of society effort by the Communist Party in China. So you have everything from Chinese organizations and entities which have to follow Chinese laws. And the laws are written in a way that by merely existing as a Chinese company, there is a requirement to collect data, harvest data, intellectual property, conduct espionage. It's written right in the law. They're not trying to hide it from anyone. And then they go as far as to use individual people. They'll send students to the United States to come into our academic institutions. The United States' greatest power is its ability to innovate. And so what happens when you're not an innovator is you have to send people to the innovation hubs and then steal the data, steal the innovation, if you will. So I think what you're seeing is at a entity level with businesses, you're seeing it with individual people. And then really what you're hearing about day in and day out right now is the cyber capabilities of the CCP is just, they are our greatest cyber adversary. And I think, really telling for you, Jeff, and for the audience is back in 2020, when FBI Director Wray made that claim, what we were seeing were economic cyber attacks all day, every day, 365 days a year, targeting economic businesses, the drivers of American innovation, stealing IP. Sadly, what we're seeing today, and I think the director noted this in his January testimony before the Select Committee on Competition with China, is the telemetry is changing. We're not seeing them push data back. They're forward positioning on our critical infrastructure, in our data centers, in our hubs, and they're doing it. You're pre-positioning for an attack. And cyber is pretty scary space. You can have a zero-day attack where you're not going to have any warning, any notice that something's happening. It's very telling. You know, we're living in an era where there's a lot happening in the Middle East. And when a country like Iran launches missiles at Israel, there's about a 14 to 15 minute notice that's coming. You see them coming. You can prepare for them coming. They're warming up the sites before they shoot. Cyber, if you're successfully in a system undetected, truly the capabilities are scary about what you can do with critical infrastructure. And so I think, you know, to tie that back to the Trojan horse conversation and why did I choose to put that piece out and why did we have that conversation is not only are they positioning themselves on our critical infrastructure, and we're not talking military and government infrastructure, we're talking about civilian water. March 18th of this year, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor with the EPA Administrator, sent a letter to all the governors across the country alerting them that their water critical infrastructure has been compromised and they need to do a thorough cyber scrub and start taking measures to mitigate. The same holds true for energy. I think about the pipelines that carry our energy up and down the country. That's high risk. You're looking at all these things. We've moved into this digital era where we want to be able to control remote or maximize the efficiencies. That's all done through digital capabilities. And then you tie that back to something as simple as an app like Temu, where once you download that app on your phone and you start making, they look like great discounts and wow, look at this. I can get something at 30, 40% off what it would cost me to order it from Amazon or from somewhere else in the United States. You're doing a multitude of damages to the United States. First, the products they're selling are probably either poor workmanship, poor craft, heavily subsidized by the Chinese Communist Party to intentionally sell below market value. It's basically dumping product in the United States. It's hurting U.S. companies. It's hurting small businesses in America. So on an economic level, you're doing damage. On the national security level, you're giving access to all your personal data. You're giving access to metadata on your phone that you don't even realize your phone's collecting. Your location, how often you're using the app. What are you doing when you use the app? And Temu, if you read the fine print, all the things that you're giving it permission to do is far exceeds what the app would ever be intended. If you were to look compared to Amazon, what Amazon asks for access on your phone when you put Amazon on your phone, Amazon's not asking to activate your camera, your microphone. It's not activating forward pushing your GPS location. All of those are things Temu does.
Let me ask you something, because that is that's shocking to a lot of listeners who may not be using that app. What is the ostensible reason, if you were to approach Temu and say, wait, why do you need all this information and data from me when I'm using your app? Amazon is not asking for that. You are. Presumably their answer is not, well, because we're collecting this for espionage purposes for the Chinese Communist Party. What is their front? What do they say publicly about the reason for this vast data collection?
So we saw how this played out when they interviewed the CEO of TikTok. They had the hearing where they questioned the CEO of TikTok on Capitol Hill. If you go back and listen to that hearing, his answers contradicted himself the entire time through that entire hearing, because the law that they must abide by, the Chinese-owned enterprise, you look at the National Cybersecurity Law of 2017, 2019, you look at the National Intelligence Law of 2017 in China. These companies are forced to provide data and facilitate intelligence activities on behalf of the CCP. In that same law, it says you're not to admit that you're doing this. You have to come up with another story. So they have no desire to be honest about what they're doing. Yet the Communist Party's law dictates that they allow the party to utilize their software, their applications, to facilitate intelligence gathering, economic espionage, and the targeting of individuals, businesses, and institutions.
Is this a phenomenon that is longstanding? Has the you've talked about since 2002 this kind of practice has been going on, but presumably as cyber infrastructure has grown incredibly important in everybody's daily life, and then obviously in the life of our government and our defense and national security agencies, has the amount of activity by the CCP grown sort of exponentially? And then have you seen that grown in recent years, or has there been a kind of slow, steady increase?
The rate of growth is something we cannot keep up with. And that's another thing I think during that early January hearing this year, General Nakasone, the director of CISA, Jen Easterly, and the FBI director all acknowledged that they have actors, whether they're hackers, they're human intelligence collectors, they outnumber our ability to investigate at sometimes 50 to 1 or more. So they're growing capabilities. And you wonder yourself, what is so intriguing that they'd want to be able to do that? Why? At the end of the day, Chairman Xi has a vision for replacing the United States at the top of the global pyramid with China. He doesn't want to share it. And he wants to own the top and be kind of the center sphere of global power. I don't think the United States is in that boat anymore where we want to be a sole superpower. I'm going to touch on that before we finish the conversation today, but I'll put that in the parking lot on foreign policy. But when you look at when you're thinking, why are we doing this? Why are we targeting this? I most clearly saw this when we were working election security and this desire to want to, control and influence outcomes without ever having to take any physical action. So if they can create turmoil in the United States, if they can create unrest amongst the populace, they cripple the federal government or state government's ability to control, to mitigate any issues that are going on domestically, project power abroad. So really at the end of the day, if we can take anything away from this, we are actively in a conflict with China today. We don't see it the way in the Western view, we're not in a conflict. We're not trading missiles and bullets.
Right. It doesn't seem like we're in some kind of open conflict.
Correct. But on the Chinese front, they very much believe they are. And so if they can win without having to fire a shot, this is the strategy they're applying today. They want to be able to control and influence politicians. They want to be able to get the American people to kind of react a certain way. It's one of the reasons why TikTok is just so dangerous if the algorithms are controlled by a foreign adversary. And by the way, China is, by law, definition, is a foreign adversary of the United States. There's four countries in a regime listed by law as foreign adversaries of the United States. China is one of them. So
is that a function? Sorry to interrupt, but just striking me, that's a really striking thing to say. That China is, by law, as you say, an adversary country. That's obviously the Chinese communist regime, not the people of China, of course.
Correct. We mean
that. But what about and you mentioned him before, Xi, President Xi. How is this connected to his, can you say more about his vision of China and his understanding? Because it does seem, when we've had other guests on our program who say, don't make a mistake, Xi is really aggressive and is sometimes openly aggressive, quietly aggressive, both of them together. And they connect a lot of the increasing adversarial tone and actions of the Chinese Communist Party to Xi's leadership. What's your analysis of that?
I couldn't agree more. Xi's leadership is a reflection of his ego. He's got a very confident, controlling ego. Over the last 5 years, it's been really interesting to watch as he takes out anything he perceives as a threat domestically, just let alone the international front. He has cleaned house within his own Communist Party and gotten rid of anyone who would question decision-making that he was doing. So he's built around nothing but a bunch of yes men around him and a party that's willing to do whatever it is he wants to do. So he's established that network over the last several years. And he has this mindset where he wants to be seen. His legacy is as the restorer of the Chinese empire. So you look, he's very intent on bringing Taiwan back into the fold. And that's something every time a U.S. official meets with the Chinese officials, doesn't matter what level, how high or low you go, they always start the conversation with that they're very upset that the U.S. would meddle with an interior issue such as Taiwan. And they make a very strong point that Taiwan is a Chinese internal domestic issue. So I think that's something where if he's able to move the needle and show that he can bring them back into the fold, that's something that I think is a legacy piece for him. The other thing the Chinese are is very patient. They develop a 100-year plan. They have a 50-year plan. They have 5-year segment plans where they work on specific items for 5 years to achieve these 50 and 100-year goals. So the reunification in their eyes of Taiwan into China is part of the 100-year plan, which is 2049, starting back to 1949 when they perceived the loss of Taiwan. So when you look at it through that context, I think you're dealing with a very patient adversary. You're dealing with somebody who's very egotistical with Xi. And, there's a lot of similarities between Xi and dictators of past. So just think about, looking at Hitler wanting to build his empire across Europe. You look at a couple of other, there's notable examples, even though there's not a direct lineage, we can see where they're behaving the same way, but there's plenty there if you're willing to look. And you'd mentioned, he says it very much out loud. He says it quietly. He demonstrates these things through action and not words. And then they're very upfront about where he sees things going in speeches.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
All right. I think a lot of our listeners are saying, okay, Brian, what should we do? You've painted a pretty grim picture. Presumably the United States has taken, is taking, and should take action to counter this threat. What steps have we taken? You outlined a few of the steps that we took that were the wrong direction. What steps have we taken, and what should we do going forward?
I think you can look at it across, again, just like China is using a whole society approach against the United States to kind of assume its global position. The United States has to be thinking of holistically, how do we address all the different fronts that China's pushing on? And when you look at, let's starting with Temu and going back to this Trojan horse in your pocket, I think you look at things like in Europe, the European Union's landmark legislation, the Digital Markets Act, is really, according to the EU, it's aimed at regulating the power of large online platforms and creating a fair space for competition in tech. But what it's actually doing is it's weakening platforms that have very secure systems. You look at something like Apple per se. Apple's operating system, even the FBI cannot get access to the Apple's operating system. You're always seeing when they have a case where there's people on iPhones, the back and forth between DOJ and Apple to get access.
They don't
to
seem
stuff
to be able to
phones.
Crack the iPhone, right?
Correct. Well, if the DMA is implemented against Apple, you're going to see exactly what you just saw happen this summer with CrowdStrike and Microsoft. The Microsoft issue that happened in the summer, I tie that directly back to EU actions taken in 2016 or 2014, where they said to make it fair that everyone can be able to move and do things on Microsoft's platform, they had to open up access to what's called the Microsoft kernel. CrowdStrike is an app that runs on Microsoft. The code they pushed back in July inadvertently touched something in the Microsoft kernel and corrupted the actual underlying operating software. So if you're forcing people to open up their secure operating systems, not only do you have these accidental CrowdStrike issues where they've, you know, inadvertently pushed code that does something that was unintended, you also have opportunities where you can bring in foreign adversaries that are making applications, put them on the App Store or the Google Store or whatever the store is that you're talking about, and have access not just to running software on the phone as a secure, like, umbrella partitioned from the main software. It's now got the ability to penetrate the actual operating system and kind of wreak havoc there. So I look at, this is something I said, and I'm starting to stand by it. The United States is so willing to regulate itself right out of being a global power. And we're doing it with some of this harmful regulation we're imposing. So I think instead of adding more regulation aimed at weakening our tech and weakening the footing that they've created, again, tech is an example of American innovation. Instead, what we should be doing is looking at ways to restrict foreign adversarial nations from putting software on these phones. And your examples are Temu and TikTok right there. WeChat is another one. So you look at these things and you think to yourself, why are we regulating for fairness? It's American innovation, and we're trying to make it fair for what? China to come into the game and then take advantage of our tech. To me, that's counterproductive, and I think, you know, that's something we should probably examine a little more closely. The other thing is just awareness at the consumer level and what you're putting on your devices, whether it's your laptop or your cell phone. It's amazing as cars continue to advance how much technology is in a car. I have kids that play ice hockey, and we were at the rink the other day, and the team visiting from Chevy Chase, Maryland, nobody had a key for their car. And to get a locker room key, you have to give the key, you know, keys to get a key. And they're like, well, our phone is our key. I don't have a key to give you. And I thought to myself, wow, that is the next phase of the problems that we're introducing to ourselves, as we are truly moving to this digital environment. We've moved away from hard physical security, and we're now really relying on digital security.
So it could get to the point, if, for example, a phone were penetrated, it could be disabled in such a way that people literally couldn't get their cars open.
You wouldn't be able to get your cars open. The path for technology to be corruptible is actually scary and endless. I've spent a lot of time traveling around the country this past year. I think I've been to 18 states talking to state legislature and governors, and we talked to them about LIDAR. It's what's going on autonomous vehicles so that they can see and avoid collisions. And there's a LIDAR company out of China that's trying again to underprice and dump its product to put other people out of business. Not only is that bad economically, but Hesai LIDAR has to follow the same national intelligence law, the same cybersecurity law. So all the data it's collecting as it's driving through the streets of America, it's got a responsibility to report that back to the CCP.
This, as you said before, a lot of the decisions that were made to open up China was a bipartisan consensus. It was Democrats and Republicans doing the same thing. Presumably, there is bipartisan support for the kind of reforms and actions you're talking about. Can you say a little bit about what you think the prospects are for any kind of bipartisan legislation or regulation at the state or federal level?
Jeff, this is the one thing in DC where we might see consensus across the aisle. So I smile. I feel like there's opportunities for us to get some wins here. The TikTok bill was actually passed. That was it's a divestment of TikTok. I'd like to see it get banned outright, but, you know, baby steps in the right direction. I would say that this issue is the most bipartisan thing in DC. Oddly enough, it's not bipartisan across the country at the state level. So I think there's still work to be done. I think that that's a failure of the Department of Homeland Security. Talk about a non-immigration failure at DHS. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis has a responsibility to get out and provide threat briefings to governors and to legislatures, and they're just not doing it. So they're unaware of what the actual national security risk is. Meanwhile, governors' offices are your largest proponent of economic development dollars, and you have companies coming into the United States trying to do business from China, and they have nefarious reasons for being here. There's an example out of Nebraska where a company, Fufeng, was trying to buy property right next to an Air Force base, US Stratcom, and they were trying to buy this property, and it would give them direct line of sight to the Air Force base. It would give them, if it has direct line of sight, it also has intelligence collections capabilities from the property. And the Nebraska state legislature introduced a bill and prevented it from happening. And I was out briefing Indiana a few short months later, and we ran into an issue where they were telling me about this land development deal worth several billions of dollars. And they're like, it's so weird. I mean, it's twice what the land is worth. And I was like, oh, well, who's it with? They're like, the governor's economic development office. It's a Chinese company. I said, do you know the name of the company? They're like, Fufeng. So here you just have another example where they're moving this time to, again, not far from a military base and straddling a U.S. railroad that's critical connection between the West and Chicago.
Wow. So if people want to learn more about this important issue and learn more about from your writings, help us again, direct us to the right place.
So I think a great place to start, especially for something that kind of hits home and makes it understandable for the average American, for somebody who's like, what happens in my state? Michael Lucci from State Armor is doing great work at getting this information out of Washington, D.C. and into the states and giving the states the tools to kind of bring the fight to China right there where they're trying to take advantage of the local communities. So State Armor is a good spot to go. And then for myself, when I'm not working at American Global Strategies for Robert O'Brien, I am often find myself writing for Heritage Foundation. So I do a lot of writing, and I've been trying to keep up with everything that's going on, trying to keep everyone apprised of all the issues that are out there.
Brian, you mentioned a few of particular Chinese companies. So you mentioned TikTok, you mentioned Temu, you mentioned Fufeng. Are there others that are, you know, our listeners, if they're thinking about their consumer choices, or they're thinking about, you know, maybe they own a business and they're thinking about purchasing product or services or digital services. Are there other companies that your research has identified as being closely connected to the Chinese Communist Party?
Absolutely. And I think this is, I can give you a couple of names and then I can give you another challenge that we're facing in the national security sphere. Whether it's a recreational drone or industrial use drone, the DJI drone company out of China is extremely problematic. It's something that I've been working very closely with a number of people to address that issue at a federal level and at a state level. You know, you have one state in particular has 95% of their drones are DJI drones for the state law enforcement.
Wow.
And the challenge there is, again, not only are you able to, there's a responsibility by DJI to collect and share data back. And I've had some interesting conversations with the information technology folks at this law enforcement entity. Oh, we've taken care of that. We've addressed it. We've got it, you know, nothing's leaving our system. And I said, well, when you get the flight firmware pushed to make sure your drone continues to fly the way it's supposed to, how do you do that? And he goes, oh, we just download the data. And I was like, every time you do that, you reopen the door. So that's a challenge. But not only that, imagine a world where you need to use that drone to conduct some type of first responder business and an adversary has the ability just to turn it off. And you saw that with the ZPMC cranes at U.S. ports. About 80% of the United States ports, the U.S. Navy is not even comfortable sending their vessels into because of the amount of ZPMC cranes and signals intelligence they can collect off of that, or the ability.
Can you say that number again? That's astonishing.
80%.
80%.
That's a big number.
Regarded as not secure. 80% of our ports are regarded as not secure enough.
The U.S. Navy has reservations about going into 80% of our ports, or relying on 80% of our ports for any type of logistical movement in wartime, because they have ZPMC cranes in them. And so the Biden administration is doing a rip and replace for these cranes. The challenge is these are massive 40-year investments. These cranes are billions of dollars. It's a lot of steel. At the end of the day, I tell you, it's the software is the problem. So the first step, instead of trying to replace an entire crane, is to rip the software out and get new operating software in there, and that at least mitigates your software issue. Some other names that folks might be familiar with are your, and again, the challenge here is, as quickly as you identify the name and the problem, is as quick as they'll change a name or rebrand and go somewhere else through another way. But a lot of people are doing these DNA testing and getting the DNA history. And so I can't confirm a name, so I don't want to use the wrong one. There's two that I'm thinking of, one's good, one's not, but off the top of mind. But one of them is owned by a Chinese entity. So every time you go to get your DNA tested, you're essentially giving your DNA to the Chinese Communist Party, because their laws force that collection of data, and you're providing DNA. And at the same time, you have, you know, the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China conducting all kinds of medical experimentation for weaponization of viruses and other diseases. So not something I'd want to do, help them. Sure, they might not be targeting you specifically, but if they understand enough of vulnerabilities in a society, they can genome create a specific variant that's an issue for targeted populations.
You previously mentioned European legislation. And I'm wondering, obviously your work is domestically, but you've also, in your time in national public policy, I'm sure, of course, connected with people from other countries who are similarly concerned about this threat. Who is the United States working with? What other countries are we working with now to try to...
The audience is it's a broad collection of countries we're trying to work with. And every country's in its own... and its own chapter in understanding its vulnerabilities to China. You look at South Korea, Japan, Australia, they are in a very different place from countries in Europe. Those three countries, the threat to them is very real. They constitute the first island chain. They're seeing activity at a pace and scale that's very real to them, what's happening. We just had an air intrusion in the Alaska Air Defense Zone. South Korea is experiencing them nearly daily. Japan's experiencing them nearly daily. The behavior of the pilots is getting more and more erratic and less professional as they're flying into these defense zones. So I think when you look at Korea, you look at Japan, you look at Australia, you have allies that feel exactly what we feel, are on the same page, maybe even a chapter ahead of us in where they're at in terms of how they want to respond to China. And I think everyone's in the same place in terms of economic ties to China. We got very lazy about manufacturing and being willing to, well, we want to clean our environment, so let's get these dirty manufacturing jobs out of our country and we'll send them to wherever it's cheap labor. And China was willing to take that on. But now you realize we didn't innovate to find clean ways to manufacture, which would have kept the jobs here domestically. And now you're in a place where, because those goods that you need, I think of car battery, CATL, cattle, another thing that customers, your listeners, as they become customers in the automotive industry, if you're looking at an electric vehicle, you probably don't want to buy a car with a CATL battery in it. I would look to some of your other competition that's not coming out of China. Right now you have CATL and Gotion coming out of China. They don't use, they're violating human rights and how they run the factories. They are basically holding rare earth processing as a lever over the West. But you have companies that are in the US and you have companies that are coming out of Korea that are doing batteries that I think are great alternatives to look to. And you think back, Ford was entangled in the CATL deal a year and a half ago in Michigan. And then meanwhile, General Motors came in and said, you know what, we're going to avoid that challenge altogether, and we're going to partner with Samsung. They're from Korea, and Samsung's got manufacturing throughout the United States. They're building semiconductors in Texas, appliances in North and South Carolina, and now they're looking to build batteries in Indiana. So I think those are opportunities where you see certain segments of the private sector acknowledging the challenge in front of us and proactively making the decision to diversify the supply chains.
Well, very important work that you're doing. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, Brian. It's just an important issue that we are, I know our listeners who care about America, our principles and what they mean in politics today and policy will care about it as well. Brian Kavanaugh, thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The American Idea.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.